what I'd like to do tonight is talk with you about something that I'm entitling Peacemaking, Hope, and Witness. For those who were here earlier, you'll recognize a few similarities to what we've been talking about for a while. But I want to go beyond that. Much of what I want to say tonight are reflections that have occurred to me over the course of the last 2 years. And I'll tell you what I've been doing for the last 2 years so you know where the reflections come from. I'm a pastor in the Lutheran Church in America who for 4 years served a parish in Appleton, Wisconsin. And in June of 1980, for a variety of reasons, our family left Appleton. I resigned the call that I had there. And we moved up to Turtle Lake, Wisconsin to become the second family to occupy an 80-acre marginal dairy farm and form a community there, an intentional community that had two purposes for existing. One was to be a Christian community, and the other was to be a peace community. So much of what I say comes out of reflections of living as an intentional peace community for almost 2.5 years. And other parts of the reflections come from the job that I'm doing professionally. I'm serving under call to special service, working with the Wisconsin Conference of Churches on a peacemaking project that's jointly sponsored and funded by about 7 or 8 different denominations at this point. And having been, I guess in many ways, on the forefront of what peace movement is happening in the state of Wisconsin, I've had a lot of time to reflect on what it means to be a part of a movement towards peace, working specifically within the church. Where I have to start is to share with you what I consider to be a fairly adequate kind of definition of peace, shalom. And again, I will give credit where credit is due. Much of my own thinking about what shalom is all about has been shaped by a little book called Things That Make for Peace. Shalom was a greeting in the Hebrew community. And if it were to be translated into idiomatic English these days, it would be to ask somebody, how are you, and really mean it, not just a polite exchange of words. And apparently the idiomatic translation in which the word was first spoken as the translation, do you have enough cash? What it reflects is a historical situation from its day. It obviously isn't a word that was ever used in a vacuum. The New Testament has a parable in it about a vineyard owner who went into the marketplace in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard that day. That was basically the historic situation of the New Testament. People were day laborers. If they were hired for a day to work in a vineyard or in a field or wherever the case might be, they went back to the marketplace in the evening and the landowner or the vineyard owner would pay them for their day's labor. That was also the place then that they would spend their money on their way home to buy food. Imagine then the impact of two Hebrew laborers greeting each other at sundown and exchanging a greeting, shalom. If they both had worked that day, presumably the answer would come back, yes, it is shalom with me. There would be other things that would go into it in addition to having food. It also included housing and clothes, and I guess it would inquire about the state of their flocks, if they had any, and about children and the rest of the family, all that. But if the answer came back yes, there was, I'm not sure they would always rejoice, but there was cause for rejoicing within the community. If the answer came back no, the responsibility was placed back on the questioner to reestablish shalom. They were a covenant of people, or a community of people who were tied together by a covenant. In the Old Testament, it was a blood covenant. Those who were born to the same tribe gradually became more a covenant of the nation, either Israel or Judah. But it was one that was aimed at inquiring about the well-being of each member of the community. What was radical, I would say, about the Old Testament covenant was that it was one unlike that of many of the other nations. It not only applied to those who by birthright were part of the community, but it was also extended to the sojourner, the person of a different nationality who happened to be passing through the community. And it said that unless even the weakest member of the community, even the weakest member, and in the Old Testament that would have been either the orphan or the widow, someone who had no way of earning a living, unless even those people were living in shalom, shalom within the entire community had broken down and it awaited reestablishment. What the New Testament did with that concept was to make it, first of all, a community that was more inclusive. One of the basic struggles of the early church was, is this new covenant one that extends only to the house of Israel, or is it something that goes beyond the house of Israel? And you know what the answer was that came back as the church struggled with it in the book of Acts. It no longer was just something that applied to the house of Israel, but now it was a new covenant that included Jews and Greeks, male and female, slave and free. And it's one that is based now for us on the assumption that reconciliation is a fact. We don't join the peace movement to make reconciliation happen. We live in reconciliation. We are reconciled. All of creation has been reconciled. That, in a kind of a shorthand way, is the definition of shalom that I bring to the task of being a peacemaker. Eventually, we have to stop talking about our ideologies and get around to action. We can spend a lot of time talking about our ideologies. And we sometimes do. It's necessary. It's important to know why you're doing what you're doing. But then you finally, I'm afraid, many of us come to the point of recognizing that nobody's ideology is quite as pure as mine. So we can argue about that until we're blue in the face. But eventually we have to go beyond conversations about our ideologies and constantly trying to purify them and clarify them and get to the point of acting. That's where I want to talk to you tonight, about action, peacemaking, as an action of hope and an action of witness. It needs to be an action of hope, first of all. There are an awful lot of people these days who are acting out of despair. Some choose to act out of despair by, in relation to things like nuclear weapons, by sticking their heads in the sand and saying, either it won't happen, God could never allow that kind of thing to happen, or by saying there's nothing I can do about it. I guess there are even some who are motivated to do something about the issue of nuclear weaponry by virtue of despair. I can't name names and point fingers because they're the ones who know, but there's a sense in which sometimes when people are engaging in civil disobedience or other actions like that, there gets to be a sense about them that they're an action born more out of frustration and despair than they are born out of hope. I say that, again, not as a way of pointing a finger at anybody, because only those people will know, but I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. I want to talk some more about what hope means, how it shows itself, what kinds of ways it gets played out. Some of the kinds of things that I think we find ourselves looking at, first of all, then, is looking at the world around us and saying, what are we going to do about it? A document that's been very helpful to me in dealing with that issue is the first draft of the statement on nuclear weapons that the National Conference of Catholic Bishops has been looking at for the last couple of months. That document has been kind of rejected by the National Conference of Bishops, and there's a second draft that should be coming out very shortly. But what the first one did, and what's caused the greatest consternation within the church, is that the bishop's statement said, no to first use of nuclear weapons. It's immoral to consider using them first. It's immoral also to think about using them in retaliation against civilian targets. It's immoral to think about even threatening their use. But then they get down to the places where you say, well, what happens? What happens if a Soviet ship fires a nuclear missile at an American ship? Maybe it's okay for that American ship to fire one back at the Soviet ship, if it's even around to do so. Because they're, you know, that can be limited to out there in the middle of the sea, and it's not going to have a whole lot of impact on civilian targets. And using the traditional just war criterion to make that kind of judgment, we can keep it away from civilian targets. It can be limited in its use out there. I mean, it may irradiate some water, but that's no terribly big deal. And then finally coming to the point of saying that we can tolerate the use or the existence of nuclear weapons as a deterrent force. We can tolerate the use of nuclear weapons as a deterrent force. Toleration, I understand, in Roman Catholic moral theology is a technical term that says, doesn't exactly justify their use, but you don't condemn it nonetheless. It's kind of there in the middle, and it doesn't fall off the fence either way. What I guess we find ourselves coming up against is what is distinctive about the Church's witness towards peace. If anything is distinctive about the Church's peace witness, it's the fact that we do bring some different kinds of understandings of human life and shalom. So then, you think about something that says we have this weapon for the sake of deterrence. And deterrence has been defined as saying we don't expect to attack another person or another country with this weapon. But we have these things for the purpose of dissuading a prospective attacker from doing violence against us. I think as we begin to look back at the definition of shalom that we established for ourselves, there's very little room in that definition of shalom for deterrence. Once you have made that kind of statement, you've set yourself on a very radical kind of course. Let me first of all talk about some of the implications that there are in taking such a course, and we may want to talk about these implications, and then move on from there to talk about where it may lead individuals who have made that choice for themselves. One of the first implications, and I guess I'd call it a pastoral care implication or a pastoral issue, something that must be dealt with somewhere along the line when a group of Christians get together and start dealing with these kinds of issues in and amongst themselves. The first pastoral issue I think that we must deal with, and we're in a place to deal with it, and a distinct place to deal with it, is the issue of self-interest. There are many people within the peace movement, certainly a lot of people who have been working in the nuclear freeze movement, who have attempted to appeal to people on the basis of self-interest. Economic self-interest, cost jobs to engage in an arms industry. And there's just cause for saying that, because it does cost jobs. Others have been motivated to join a movement towards peace because we want to save our lives, the lives of our children, the lives of our grandchildren. And again, there's just cause for saying that. But eventually, along the line, we have to deal with the fact that there must be more than simple self-interest. I recently was listening to someone who was talking about peace concerns in general, and he was saying that, from his perspective, he felt it was necessary to appeal to our political leaders on the basis of self-interest. This was a leader in the church. And as we talked about it a little bit farther, I reflected back to him that I'm not sure I see any place in the Gospels or in the biblical witness as a whole where self-interest is condoned or encouraged as a motivation for doing anything. What he was talking about was something, and it's a phrase that's thrown around a great deal, enlightened self-interest. Enlightened self-interest will lead us to deal with issues like nuclear weaponry, hunger, etc., etc. And it appears to me from looking at the scriptures that there are probably three kinds of self-interest. There's self-interest, and then there's self-interest, and then there's self-interest. And there's no such thing as enlightened self-interest. It is always self-interest. It is interest in myself. And Shalom says there is my interest and your interest. Never my interest alone. There is always my interest and your interest. I've been accused recently of advocating class suicide when I say that. But I think there are those kinds of implications in it. A peace movement is not a way to secure a better future for ourselves or for me. The peace movement is not a way to ensure that I will continue to live. The peace movement is not a way to ensure that my economic standard will continue to go up. The peace movement, as it must exist within the church, is one that says, I have some interests, but there are an awful lot of other people that have some interests too, because it is a movement also towards justice. It was Pope Paul VI who was the first in recent history to say, if you want peace, work for justice. The next of the pastoral care kinds of issues that we find ourselves dealing with is that we simultaneously find ourselves talking to structures as well as to individuals. We talk to structures when the voters in the state of Wisconsin pass a referendum that says freeze the nuclear arms race, and as other states do that. But it's a very different kind of thing when we suddenly find ourselves speaking to individuals. The bishop of the Amarillo Diocese of the Roman Catholic Church has encouraged members of that diocese who work at the Pentax plant in Amarillo, where the nuclear weapons are assembled, to quit their jobs. Quit their jobs because what they're doing, by his definition, is immoral. There are some strong, heavy implications of what he has said there. First of all, to suggest to them that it would be immoral for them to be working there. And then secondly, the implication of what are they supposed to do? He has dealt with that issue by saying, we will make sure that nobody who does that finds themselves out on the street starving to death. So they've actively taken over that kind of concern for Shalom. When Shalom has broken down within that community, there are those who are there to pick up the pieces. But as leaders within the church, whatever form your leadership takes, there must be a sensitivity to the fact that there are lots of other human kinds of issues going on there, and it's our place to be involved in that, because peacemaking must also be an act of reestablishing shalom within our basic communities, as well as looking at where shalom has broken down in the international community. Where that leads us, I think, it doesn't lead us to a place of just kind of floating around and saying, well, we can't do anything about it because we don't dare condemn somebody else's actions. It leads us to a place where each individual, I think, begins to determine for her or himself what form their witness is going to take. The way that I guess I've reflected on that in recent times is to picture before myself a spectrum, a line, a circle, if you will. Maybe circles work better for spectrums even. And it's a spectrum of resistance. Everybody's a resistor in one form or another. Some people's form of resistance just takes some more radical shapes. When somebody writes a letter to their senator or their congressperson, you're a resistor. That hasn't always been a real popular kind of idea in the United States. I think we've lost touch to a great degree with the fact that there is a place, a good place, an affirmed place for the loyal opposition. Those who are criticizers, and criticizers doesn't mean just people who bitch and chew. It means people who ask questions. People who are prepared to look long and hard at something. When it needs affirming, to affirm it. And when it needs criticizing, correcting, to correct it. That's what resistance is all about. What makes resistance a difficult kind of thing for us is that, unlike so many other things in our lives that are dictated by democratic process, resistance is not dictated by democratic process. If you want to wait until a vote has been passed, legalizing something, then it is no longer resistance. Resistance takes shape in the minds and the lives and the actions of individuals. There's no vote that takes place. It's something that, as I say, takes shape in the minds and the lives of people who then begin to put it into action. Quite often, when somebody begins to resist, a community springs up around that person, which becomes the support community. And support for those who are resisting is absolutely essential. Over the long haul, you can't do it by yourself. The community will spring up, but it will follow resistance. Therefore, as I say, resisting, I think, must precede both the vote and the community. Then I want to just say a few more things about what shape hope takes in the midst of that witness, that resistance. Then I'd like to throw it open to you to hear your comments on it and what kinds of forms your own resistance has taken. What are the impediments that all of us face? How do you deal with them in your own life? Where do you find the courage to be a resistor yourself? What it finally comes down to is resistance, witnessing, is a proclamation of hope. Proclamation of hopefulness. Hope is distinctly different from optimism, however. Optimism looks at what lies in front of one and says, what are the odds of success? And if the odds are better than 50%, usually much better than 50%, depending upon how much of a gambler you are, you get on the wagon. And if the odds ever drop back below 50%, more than likely you'll get off. That's not hope. That's optimism. Hope is that which looks at what needs to be done and does it. Quite often being called crazy along the line, quite often being called impractical and naive and idealistic, all kinds of other things, but that is the basis of hope. Hope, as I see it, is first of all utterly realistic. Hope is not naive. Hope is not terribly idealistic, as that is used as a bad sense. Hope is utterly realistic. Let me give you one example in a place where I think it's worthy of our saying it and saying it loud and clear. We're living in a complex world. Nobody would argue with that. We're living in a world in which conflict is a reality. We're living in a world that sees conflicting ideologies. We're living in a world that sees conflicting interests between national groups and community groups and state groups, and every place you look, there is conflict. It's conflict that's perpetrated by such things as the fact that there's a fixed landmass on the face of the earth, by the fact that the number of resources on the face of the earth are a limited quantity, it's a finite quantity. It may still be a huge quantity, but it is a finite quantity nonetheless. It's brought on by the fact that population continues to grow putting a strain on the landmass and on the number of resources that there are available. And all of that boils down to saying there is conflict. We don't need to deny that fact. We don't need to say peace can only exist when there is no longer conflict on the face of the earth. But we have some choices as to how we respond to it. Prophets, P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, those kinds of prophets, have been the people who have spoken to such things. I think prophets throughout the history of humanity have always taken some very unusual forms, and they've been usually the least likely people. One of the contemporary prophets who has spoken to that reality of conflict is the French philosopher Albert Camus, who already back in the 1940s wrote an essay that was reprinted by the French underground, and it has subsequently been reprinted in English, an essay that's called Neither Victims Nor Executioners. And in that essay he says, I'm not so naive as to think we'll ever see a day in which war and murder and violence and oppression disappear from the face of the earth. I'm not so crazy as to think I'll ever see that. But I do look forward to a day in which war and murder and violence and oppression are no longer legitimate. I do look forward to a day in which they are no longer legitimate means to resolve our conflicts. And I think today, more than ever before in the course of human history, we can be utterly realistic in saying that. We have come to a point where war and murder and violence and oppression dare no longer be legitimate means of resolving our conflicts. They dare not be, because if we try using them, it'll be suicide. And I think we can advocate for that and advocate for it strongly. Another of our proclamations of hope that must be a part of our words as well as our actions is one that announces the reality of reconciliation and announces the reality of global community. And that'll cause us to examine a lot of the rhetoric that's tossed around these days. It's amazing how easy it is to identify enemies these days. It's also amazing how relative and how changeable that identification of enemies is. One of the interesting kind of exercise that I've asked people to do at times is to think back 40 years. For some of us, that's impossible. But do it on the basis of the history books or something. Think back 40 years ago today, October 7th, 1942. Who were our friends? Our allies? Soviet Union? China?
England?
France? Who are our enemies? Germany, Japan, Italy. Project yourself ahead to today. Who are our friends? Germany, Japan. Well, let's use the word friends loosely. Our allies. Germany, Japan, Italy, France, Britain. Who is our major enemy? The Soviet Union. And you can compress that even more by thinking how our relationships with Red China have changed just over the course of the last 15 years. We have much reason to remind ourselves of the reality of global community. Another analogy that has made a great deal of sense to me is one that deals with, again, with our relationship with the Soviet Union. We have in recent years come to recognize planet Earth as a kind of a lifeboat. But for some reason, I think we've gotten the idea that there are two lifeboats. There's a Soviet lifeboat and a U.S. lifeboat. And we have made every effort possible to drill holes in the Soviet lifeboat to make it sink, because we want them to be Western Christian capitalists like we are. When you start looking at that a little bit more closely, I think we begin to see that we're sitting in the lifeboat, the same lifeboat, and they're on one end and we're on the other, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for us to try drilling holes in their end of the lifeboat, because we're both going to go down together. That may be a little bit trite and flippant. I don't mean it to be that way. What global community calls upon us to recognize is the fact that our fates, our very lives, are tied up with the lives of the people in the Soviet Union and the people in China and the people in South and Central America and the people in South Africa. The world has become too small for us to look only at our own self-interests. It is absolutely essential for us to remind each other of how easy it is for us to lapse into enemy language, how easy it is for us to lapse into a kind of a narrow definition of shalom that looks only at our own well-being and forgets about the fact that quite often our well-being is built on the backs of somebody else. Finally, what hope is all about is being in relationship to the cross and grappling long and hard with what the cross means. The cross is a paradox. It's the ultimate symbol of death, yet for us it has come to be the giver of life. What that means for us to be in relationship to the cross brings me personally to about the hardest mouthful of words I've ever had to say to myself. And that's a mouthful of words that says, in spite of all the time and the energy that I've invested in peace education in the last 2 years, and in spite of all the time and energy that thousands of other people have invested in it, we may not stop the bombs from falling. And that even that doesn't take away our hope. Rather, what hope does is calls on us to say no to death. We, unlike any other generation in the history of the world, have succeeded in harnessing the power of death to a degree unparalleled. We, unlike any other group of people in the course of human history, are those who have learned to manipulate the power of death and are in a position to be able to use that not only against others, but also, obviously, it would come raining down on our own heads. And we're in a position to be able to say we have so much hope that we're prepared to say no to death. We're prepared to refuse to use the power of death to secure our own lives, because for us, death no longer is the ultimate enemy. It's the limiter. It puts the final limit on our life as we know it. But it doesn't have the final word, because we can say no to death. Hope often sets people on a head-to-head confrontation with death. But it does not ever take hope away from people. What that means is that we need to be looking at a very, very different kind of definition of freedom. It's freedom and hope, I guess, get tied very closely together. Freedom is not my ability to have whatever I want. Freedom is not my ability to buy whatever I want. Freedom is not my ability to go wherever I want. Freedom is not my ability to believe whatever I want, and anything else like that, to say whatever I want. Because freedom, in its ultimate sense, cannot be taken away by depriving me of money so that I can't buy things. Freedom in its ultimate sense cannot be taken away by locking me in jail so that I can't move around. Freedom can't even be taken away, in the strongest sense of the word, by taking my life. You've taken my ability to choose away at that point, but you have not taken away the basic kind of freedom. I can only give my freedom away. I can only give it away, and I guess the way that we're seduced into giving our freedom away these days is to making a pact with the power of death and saying we will do anything in our power to maintain that other kind of freedom that says I must be able to buy whatever I want and go wherever I want. That is not the kind of freedom that I think is consistent with shalom. Hope and witness, when it comes right down to it, has one purpose and one purpose alone, and that is the purpose of affirming life, the possibility of life, my life, your life, and the life of the global community and the life of the earth itself. Depends upon what day of the week you ask. For an experiment, it's not working bad. We've discovered it to be a place where people can be accessible to each other, can be vulnerable to each other, a place where it's possible to take some risks that might not be possible otherwise. For example, we live as one economic unit in the community, which has allowed us the freedom to not all have to think about working for money full time. It's allowed us the freedom to be able to have some people working for financial things in the community, other people to do the jobs that are necessary just to keep a group of people going, like cutting firewood and canning tomatoes, and some other people have the exciting freedom of just being able to do in the larger community what needs to be done and not have to think about doing it for wages. Things like helping farmers chase their cows into the barn off the road, working with a local peacemaking group or whatever the case may be. We have a lot of freedom that way. I think it's enriched our lives and our children's lives in that it has brought us into a place where we can model peacemaking with each other. We can actively say to each other, even though we disagree on some sometimes substantial and sometimes unsubstantial things, that we can work together and live together and function quite well. It's provided for us the support community, or at least a start for a support community in terms of doing actions of resistance. The other family that's there has been engaged in tax resistance for quite a number of years. And the Internal Revenue Service is rather anxious to collect from them. But because of the fact that not everybody needs to be a cash wage earner, it's possible to keep that dialogue with the Internal Revenue Service about what they're doing going for a good long time, because the Internal Revenue Service is unable to get the money and call off the conversation. It also allows us the option of another form of tax resistance, which is simply living more simply so that you don't have to pay any taxes. Because there are all those people around to do other kinds of things, we quite frankly don't need as much money to live on. And because we don't need as much money to live on, we don't have to pay taxes on it. My relationship is, I guess, the same as most any other pastor of the Lutheran Church in America. People in the Lutheran Church in America have calls to parishes. I have called a special service that in which they affirm my work with the Wisconsin Conference of Churches. So my paycheck comes not just from the Wisconsin Upper Michigan Synod of the Lutheran Church in America. It comes from them, as well as the Methodists and the Presbyterians and the United Church of Christ and the American Lutheran Church, Church of the Brethren, Church Women United, and a few other various and sundry groups. Yes?
I have roughly two poorly defined questions.
Okay.
So please bear with me on that. The resistance, the movement, the community, the attitude of which you speak is one of maturity.
Of what?
Of maturity.
Okay.
And I think that is an admirable kind of a thing. I think it's a place that we desire to be and we would wish others to be. But the question, one of the questions that I have is it's very difficult, using another analogy, it's very difficult to use the process to dealing in a mature way with other adults. Let me rephrase that. It's very difficult to use the same way of helping adults grow as it is to use the same way of helping children grow. And if we are to say, for example, that we are trying to attempt to deal with this issue in a mature way, whereas those who are in control on both sides, I would tend to put someplace around age 8. I'm questioning the quote feasibility of that. I'm very tend to use the word feasibility when we're talking visionary kinds of language.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of one of the questions. The second thing that I'd like to go back to in the very beginning is I'm unclear as how you make the jump from the concept of shalom to not including deterrence, particularly if the deterrence are going to keep other communities alive.
Okay, let me answer the first one first, because it's easier, I think. The reason those people, whatever age we want to call them, the reason they have the opportunity to some degree, and that's not totally, but to some degree, the reason they have the ability to do what they're doing is because we've given them power. We've given away our responsibility. We have not always been terribly mature people, because mature people, I think, do take responsibility for themselves and for their decision making and for the decisions that are happening around them. And we certainly have not been real good at taking responsibility for that. It's not always been the easiest thing to do either. There have been a lot of causes that have made it difficult to be responsible decision makers in relationship to public policy. But I think we have to begin by taking back some of that responsibility, some of that decision making for ourselves. How I make the jump from shalom to not or disallowing deterrence, I guess, is one that again is based on some of the assumptions I was sharing with you towards the end, that first of all, we'll probably be on a head-to-head with death. Now, I can make that decision for myself. I can't make it for anybody else, but I can make it for myself. And also one that's based heavily on the assumption that some of the injunctions in the Sermon on the Mount, specifically in Matthew 5, are things that are meant to be taken quite literally. That says, love your enemy and pray for your persecutor. I don't use that, however, as a way of advocating isolationism or saying, well, you know, somebody in South America is suffering, but that's too bad, I can't intervene. I think there are those places, well, you know, clearly in terms of world politics these days, there are places in which we are in complicity with that. We allow that to happen. What gets tangled up in it is the fact that I can't make a pacifist, and that basically is what I'm talking about, is a kind of a pacifist stand. I can't tell somebody else to be a pacifist. I can make that statement for myself. So I can say, I will do whatever it is that I can to make my own complicity in the situation end, which is something that I can do something about in terms of our own political process here. I will make every effort to make sure that the army in the United States does not enter that situation, because all too often I'm afraid we've entered and we've been on the wrong side, at least in our recent history. And that leaves the way clear for people in that country, first of all, to deal with it in our own way. And it also leaves them free then to choose a pacifist response for themselves. We're talking about a couple of different things at the same time. On the one hand, we're talking about political strategy, and on the other hand, we're talking about faithfulness to the gospel. Pacifism, obviously, is not the most successful political strategy, because it costs lives. But I guess my feeling about it in relationship to other countries throughout the world is that we need to leave them to be free to make their own decision about how they will respond to injustice in their midst. It's a hard question for me to ask about violent revolution in South Africa, violent revolution in Central America and South America. It's a hard thing for me to look at that. But one of the other, I guess one of the other ways that I also have to look at it is from the view of Lutheran ethical decision making, that fortunately has reminded me of the fact that pacifism is no more justifying than engaging in war making. So we find ourselves in that kind of ethical no man's land that says, I can say for me here and now that war making is not a good thing, but I can't say that for them as much as I'd like to. Take this for what it's worth as my assessment of the situation and things that are available to people to do, things that I think are appropriate actions, and then also remind yourself of the fact that it's got to be ultimately your decision. Some of the places where people, I think, are resisting in some appropriate ways are in relationship to the draft, non-registration. Tax resistance is one way that I think is available to people. One of the things that I think it's important to remember in terms of doing tax resistance or any other kind of resistance is that, first of all, there is the necessity to be prepared to take the consequences for it. And secondly, in terms of tax resistance, the purpose of tax resistance is not to put a few more dollars into my own pocket. It's not tax evasion, it's tax resistance. And what happens with, I think, most people who engage in tax resistance for religious / humanist reasons is that they will take that money and put it into an alternative fund, donate it to a group that's doing human service kinds of things or something like that. One of the nicest things about it these days is that, nice kind of tongue-in-cheek, is that as the military budget has gone up, obviously the social service budget has gone down, and you have an opportunity there to supplement the social service budget. It can be involved in directly meeting human needs. I think other kinds of resistance modes that are available to people is simply being willing to take the risk of talking. There are an awful lot of people who just don't want to talk about the risks that we're facing these days. Some because it's just too dreadful to think about it or to talk about it. Others who are still suffering from the illusion that it somehow is unpatriotic or unorthodox to talk about such things and to raise questions about it. There need to be people who are prepared to take the risk to do that. I think there need to be people who are prepared to take the risk of living differently, simply adopting a different style of life, making a deliberate choice not to respond to the need to sell things, if you will. It's just one example that comes to my mind. It causes people, I think, to have to take a look at their life and the things that we support either explicitly or implicitly and say, do I want to support those things? As I judge those things over against the definition of shalom, do I want to continue to support those things or not? And there are all kinds of dehumanizing things, unpeaceful things that are happening. It's not just a question of war and peace. It's a question of how parents treat their children and how children treat their parents and how men treat women and women treat men and all kinds of other things like that that call for resistance in a lot of different forms.
The forces that are pushing us toward the millennium of destruction are very great, and I don't think they can be met by small measures. I think one measure that we might push toward and be concrete in is demanding, each of us personally, that our president say, make as strong a statement as Brezhnev made, that we will not cast the first stone. If that statement could be made, what a shame we didn't make it before Brezhnev.
Right.
If he or someone in his position could make that statement, we would have a stalemate of antagonism. Another thing I think we could do, we could influence propaganda so that we do not continue to create an enemy. The first and strongest step toward peace is to stop creating an enemy. Why was the bomb dropped on Hiroshima? Because Japan created an enemy. The third thing I think we could do, which seems less concrete, but actually would not be, would be to encourage and increase the number of us who meditate. It has been said that if 1 million people were meditating at this moment, we would achieve peace. And that 1 million begins with one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the rhythm, as it's been described by some, the rhythm between action and contemplation is an indispensable one. Taking time to, one of the effects, I think, is to just be at peace with oneself. And if you're able to be at peace with yourself, it certainly will be possible to be at peace with others around you.
Yeah. Meditation gives you strength to do something.
Yes. Well, it feels it. Perhaps we're running out of gas. That seems like it might be an appropriate time to stop talking.